said I've had a vision, and you know I'm strong and holy. I must do what I've been told. So we started up the mountain. I was running, he was walking, and his axe was made of gold. Well, the trees, they got much smaller. The lake, lady's mirror. We stopped to drink some wine. Then he threw the bottle over, broke a minute later, and he put his hand on mine. Thought I saw an eagle, but it might have been a vulture. I never could decide. Then my father built an altar. He looked once behind his shoulder. He knew I would not hide. You who build the altars now to sacrifice these children, you must not do it anymore. A scheme is not a vision. You never have been tempted by a demon or a god. You who stand above them now, your hatchets blunt and bloody, you were not there before.
Hello, this is Jack Layton, and you're listening to CFRC. Think critically.
Turtle Island to Palestine. Occupation is a crime. Free, free Palestine. You're listening to Radio Free Palestine.
Welcome, everyone. You are listening to Under the Olive Tree, the Palestine Solidarity Radio Show on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal and on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario.
Really, these distribution points and this aid mechanism is a way to achieve ethnically cleansing Gaza and of moving the population south. And this is not to mention the use of the foundation or the distribution point as tools of collective punishment through the very undignified and inhumane way of managing these distribution points, which are constructed as narrow cages that Palestinians have to be crammed into in order to access aid. And there's been repeated massacres as well.
From Ashabaka, the Palestinian Policy Network, I am Yara Hawari, and this is Rethinking Palestine. This episode was recorded prior to the start of Israel's war with Iran, which has already claimed the lives of hundreds of civilians, mostly Iranian. Meanwhile, the Israeli regime continues to kill dozens of Palestinians on a daily basis in its ongoing genocide in Gaza, and is still limiting the entry of aid to a population that is being deliberately kept on the brink of starvation. This episode focuses on the use of private security contractors and the weaponization of aid more broadly. Private security contractors, usually former military or secret service personnel from the global north, have long been a feature of so-called war zones. They were used extensively in Iraq and Afghanistan, and Palestine is no stranger to their fair share. Recently, we have seen their deployment in Gaza, and in particular, they have been used to secure a new Israeli-backed US aid distribution mechanism, a mechanism which has received widespread critique and has also been accused of facilitating war crimes by UN officials. The privatization of aid and security in Gaza has had deadly consequences. Indeed, many Palestinians have been shot and killed at these new aid distribution sites. It also paints a worrying future for aid in Palestine and beyond, where local and international institutions like UNRWA and other UN agencies are eroded and eventually replaced. Joining me to discuss this on this episode of Rethinking Palestine is Safa Joudeh, a postdoctoral researcher at the Arab and Islamic Studies Institute at the University of Exeter. Safar recently published a policy memo on this very topic for Ashabaka, which can be found on our website, al-shabaka.org. Safar, thank you for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
Can you give us an overview of how private security contractors have been used during the genocide and what have they been typically recruited to do?
Yes, in the current context, since the beginning of Israel's assault on Gaza in October 2023, private contractors have primarily been involved in aid distribution and in managing security operations and logistics tied to aid. The main operation that private security contractors were recruited to manage is the operation of the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation. The foundation was established in February 2025 by the Israeli and American governments in order to provide aid or to manage aid delivery into Gaza. And it has four distribution points in the southern Gaza Strip, which are controlled by armed personnel, private American security contractors. And these armed personnel are hired or recruited to manage aid distribution operations in these sites. They work in cooperation with the Israeli army. And so the sites are surrounded by Israeli military patrols. And the job of the security contractors is to manage the operational side, to screen individuals, conduct identity checks, do crowd control, etc.
So US private security contractors were deployed quite early on in the genocide, I think mainly to secure the US floating pier. Can you tell us more about that?
Yes, in early 2024, the US announced plans to build a temporary pier off the coast of Gaza to facilitate aid delivery, the delivery of food, water, medicine, at a time when Israel was increasing the blockade or intensifying the blockade on Gaza. Private security contractors were hired to build and manage logistics and to operate the pier as well. They were US private contractors, though the nature, the names of the companies weren't really released, but reports indicate that they were companies that had operated previously in Iraq and Afghanistan, constructed the pier and were there on the ground to manage aid delivery. The pier suffered damage and there were other logistical complications. And so it was dismantled after, I think, only 3 weeks in operation. So it wasn't really effective as a solution or a model in boosting humanitarian aid. But the idea primarily was to bypass land routes, was to bypass traditional mechanisms of delivering aid, primarily through crossings, land crossings, mainly the Kerem Shalom and the Rafah crossings, which Israel had either restricted or closed off at the time. But the bigger picture also is to sort of establish these private entities working under Israeli oversight and to bypass not just traditional land routes, but also traditional aid delivery mechanisms carried out by NGOs and by UN staff. Highly problematic, not transparent. Again, the nature of these forces, the companies they belonged to, was all information that was never released. And so no international bodies, no local bodies involved in these operations, no kind of legal mechanism or legal oversight. And just another example of how Israel is experimenting with new aid distribution and broader governance models that would be able to bypass existing mechanisms and establish Israeli control indirectly by outsourcing these operations to private entities.
So far, you've mentioned that these security contractors have been used to secure this new aid distribution mechanism. And you mentioned that it is American and receives backing from the Israeli regime. Can you tell us a bit more about it? Who's behind it? What are the sort of different bodies involved?
Yes, so the new aid distribution mechanism is significantly different from the traditional system of aid delivery in Gaza that was used before the genocide. It's highly centralized under one entity, which is the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation. It's deeply politicized and it's deeply militarized as well. So the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation is a political entity. It was founded and funded by the U.S. State Department in cooperation with the Israeli government, though funding sources are still quite opaque. But there are reports that the Israeli Mossad was also involved in the funding. The foundation involves consulting groups that have been linked to the Pentagon and other branches of the U.S. military. Some of them are headquartered in the U.S., some like the Boston Consulting Group, which participated in the design and the planning, the operational planning of the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation. The Boston group is headquartered in Israel, among its offices, a large headquarters in Israel. And of course, there's a heavy reliance on private security contractors, U.S.-based companies that are employed to execute plans on the ground to manage aid, the entry of aid, and to manage and control access to aid. So again, it's a deeply problematic, politicized model where humanitarian functions are outsourced to politicized and militarized bodies, undermining humanitarian norms and using food and aid as a weapon of control. And the bigger picture here is not simply the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation, but this emerging models that can be seen in aid distribution, also in security operations, in checkpoint and population management, and other aid distribution initiatives, such as the American-led pier off the coast of Gaza. And this model of organizing humanitarian supplies and distributing supplies aims to bypass the existing system, the existing mechanisms that are traditionally carried out by neutral humanitarian actors, and to place sort of oversight and control of humanitarian operations with the Israeli army. So there's a lot of questions around transparency, around accountability, potential violations, very dangerous conditions, and of course, the bigger picture of what kind of political landscape Israel is trying to formulate and to impose on Gaza.
This new mechanism functioning, what does it look like? How are they distributing aid?
So the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation is in the form of distribution, aid distribution zone or distribution points that are located in the southern Gaza Strip. They are points that are patrolled and controlled by private security contractors who manage aid distribution in these sites under the oversight of the Israeli army. There are four distribution sites in the southern Gaza Strip, and really, the UN has called this a fig leaf or a way for Israel to manage the movement of the population or demographic control of the Gaza population by forcing people to relocate to the southern parts of Gaza or risk starvation, because Israel has prevented the entry of aid and the distribution of aid in any location beyond the four distribution sites of the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation. So this has been a plan that has been put into action through repeated evacuations, forcing people to the south of Gaza, mass destruction of neighborhoods and of homes, of infrastructure. But it's also a plan that has been laid out by Israeli officials. In the most recent ground offensive, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu announced that Israeli forces would take control all of Gaza and limit the presence of Palestinians to pre-designated zones. Israeli Finance Minister Bezalel Smotrich has also said that the entirety of Gaza would be destroyed. And so really these distribution points and this aid mechanism is a way to achieve these objectives of ethnically cleansing Gaza and of moving the population south. And this is not to mention the use of the foundation or the distribution points as tools of collective punishment through the very undignified and inhumane way of managing these distribution points, which are constructed as narrow cages that Palestinians have to be crammed into in order to access aid. And Palestinians who, you know, there's been repeated massacres as well of Palestinians who have to walk for miles to access aid to get to these distribution points. So clearly these distribution sites are not acting as a humanitarian lifeline, but more as a tool of democratic and territorial control.
And we've all seen those horrific images of tens of thousands of Palestinians being, you know, forced to scramble for these very small aid boxes. And these sites have been referred to by many as essentially death traps. And it's really telling as well that many UN officials have said that this aid mechanism will be used to facilitate war crimes of forced displacement, you know, weaponization of aid, etc. So it's not only is it having sort of real time, very deadly consequences, it also does not bode well for the future of the aid landscape in Gaza, but also beyond.
In terms of what the situation will look like in Gaza the day after the war, and in terms of post-war governance, it seems through the arrangements that Israel is putting into place now that, you know, we're getting a view of what Israel's plans are for who will administer Gaza. There's been no substantial conversation towards planning for the post-war situation beyond the fact that it appears that Israel is not invested in reoccupying or retaking Gaza. It's unlikely that Hamas will be able to play a role in Gaza's governance, even if Israel fails to destroy or disarm it and Hamas continues to exist as a political organization. Hamas itself has announced that it's relinquishing control of post-war administering or governance of Gaza. So Hamas is unlikely to be there. Israel has refused any sort of suggestion for the PA to assume the role of administering Gaza. And so it appears that there will be a void. And the question is, who will fill this void? And it seems like what Israel is doing is constructing a landscape of a number of concentration camps, which are ruled by Israel-backed armed gangs or militias that are being funded and supported and backed by Israel now to operate in Gaza. And the population's needs will be administered and met through these aid distribution points that Israel is setting up almost as a pilot for some sort of permanent arrangement in order to provide services for the remaining population. So it's really a very worrying question about what will the post-war governance landscape look like. And it requires attention and serious action if a disastrous and tragic situation like the one we are seeing now at present is to be avoided.
So why are the Israelis trying to erode existing mechanisms for the distribution of aid, and why are they trying to erode UN institutions when it's actually previously relied on them to shoulder the responsibility of the continued occupation?
UN bodies, especially UNRWA, have been providing humanitarian services in Gaza for decades. The UN, I think 15 UN agencies, along with a network of NGOs and partners, alongside traditional Palestinian governmental bodies, have been responsible for providing education services, healthcare services, food, medical services to Palestinians for a long time now. And Israel allowed this or sort of maintained the stable formula or the stable system and actually relied on the UN and the international community alongside conventional Palestinian leadership for a reason, which is Israel was able to maintain its occupation, its control of whether it's Gaza or as well in the West Bank, maintain a system of occupation and control without actually having to shoulder the responsibility, the cost, and being responsible for the welfare of the Palestinian population, of the population it occupies. After October 7th, Israel has sort of moved towards having greater security control, greater surveillance over Gaza. And this has sort of been consolidated in looking to replace the existing system, the governance system, the aid delivery system, primarily led by the UN and UNRWA in particular, with a centralized aid delivery system in the form of the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation, which operates under Israeli and U.S. control and security coordination. So this is a sort of in the medium term. In the bigger picture, UNRWA's mandate is specifically UNRWA, which provides the majority of education, primary education and medical services to humanitarian services to Palestinians. Its mandate is rooted in Palestinian right to return. And it is the institutional sort of expression and protection of this right. And so by dismantling UNRWA and doing its work in Gaza, Israel wants to end the legal status of Palestinian refugees and their claim to their right of return, and turn this state of displacement and also the annexation of Gaza, plans to annex parts of Gaza, into a permanent arrangement.
And as you said, Hamas will not have any role in governing post-genocide. That has been made clear. And the Israelis have also said that the PA should not have a role in that either. And so where does that leave local institutions that have been very much, you know, involved in efforts to distribute aid to local communities?
I think something that is really important to talk about, which is, I think, left out of the conversation, is what the existing governance arrangements looked like before October 7th in Gaza. The government apparatus, the management of government institutions and departments. As a ruling party in Gaza, Hamas took control of ministries, of governmental institutions, by installing Hamas employees and officials at the management level of these institutions and departments, figures who were sometimes, though not always, politically aligned with Hamas. But the overall structure of governance institutions, the structure, the administrative structure of these bodies, is something that was inherited from the PA. It existed prior to Hamas. Many of the key institutions and government bodies, in fact, almost all of them, weren't changed. Technical and administrative staff in all fields remained in their departments, providing public services to residents. So really much of this structure was inherited from the PA. It's been built up since 1994. There was no parallel governance structure that Hamas somehow controlled and used to govern Gaza, which would technically mean that it's possible to end Hamas's governing role in Gaza by removing its officials from the government apparatus, you know, managers, politically aligned figures, while maintaining the formal structures of these government institutions and the bureaucracy, which is staffed with thousands of employees who have no affiliation with Hamas across these departments. But it's very clear that Israel is not out to undermine Hamas or to destroy Hamas. It's out to destroy Palestinian self-rule by creating a complete breakdown in governance in Gaza and removing these structures that existed. And this is very clear through targeting government and municipal buildings alongside targeting, you know, public infrastructure, water, sewage, electricity, etc., impeding the ability of these institutions and their employees to provide services during this genocide, whether it's coordination with the UN on schooling, whether it's enforcing law and order, whether it's clearing rubble, etc. And so Israel is interested in not only maintaining this division, political divide between Gaza and Ramallah, but by completely decimating the governance infrastructure in Gaza to prevent the ability of independent and autonomous self-rule to happen again after the genocide and the day after.
Right. And so in this way, this aid mechanism that uses private US private security contracts could be a test run for what Israel envisions for the governance of Gaza. I mean, literally outsourcing governance to colonial actors.
It is very possible. And again, Israel is not interested in having boots on the ground in Gaza and reoccupying or committing you know, military forces to remain in Gaza. It's costly. It's not a popular option. And at the same time, having the PA reassume responsibility of administering Gaza would allow Palestinians in some way to form a unified sort of structure and begin to sort of build up that structure after, you know, years of division and collapse. And so it appears that you know, is there's no interest in having a legitimate civilian administration to run Gaza. And this is where this experiment of outsourced, privatized governance in aid, in security, but also in other sectors and spheres comes in.
Safwat, thank you so much for joining me on this episode of Rethinking Palestine.
Thank you, Yara.
Rethinking Palestine is brought to you by Ashabaka, the Palestinian Policy Network. Ashabaka is the only global independent Palestinian think tank whose mission is to produce critical policy analysis and collectively imagine a new policy-making paradigm for Palestine and Palestinians worldwide. For more information or to donate to support our work, visit al-shabaka.org. And importantly, don't forget to subscribe to Rethinking Palestine wherever you listen to podcasts.
Listen, I'm 24 and I still can't forget one day I lived through in Palestine. Every airplane is a trigger. Every loud noise is a trigger. Every slam of a door is a trigger. And it brings me back.
Welcome to This is Palestine. I'm Deanna Boutu. In today's episode, I speak with Yara Eid, who is a Palestinian journalist and human rights activist from Gaza, though she's currently based in London. Yara has worked with international organizations, including Amnesty International, and she uses her very large platform to shed light on life under Israeli occupation and under Israeli apartheid, particularly in Gaza. Yara is known for her viral interview on Sky News, where she directly challenged the anchor's dehumanizing portrayal of Palestinians. Her calm yet firm response highlighted the media's double standards when it comes to reporting on Palestine. This interview brought global attention to the biased narratives that are often used when covering Israel's genocide in Gaza. Yara's reporting focuses on the lived realities of life under Israeli occupation and under Israeli siege and blockade. She began her career by interning at Al Ayn Media Company in Gaza, which was founded by two journalists, Rushdie Sarraj and Yasser Morteja. Rushdie was killed in the early weeks of this ongoing genocide in Gaza, while Yasser was killed in April of 2018 while covering the Great March of Return. Yara has worked as a war journalist on the ground, covering the 2021 Israeli aggression on Gaza and documenting its devastating impact on civilians. Finally, Yara's recent work has appeared in outlets such as Al Jazeera and the Los Angeles Times. Through her reporting, she shares not only the broader realities of Israeli attacks, but also on her personal losses, including family members and friends who've been killed by Israel. Since October of 2023, during Israel's ongoing genocide in Gaza, Israel has killed 90 of Yara's family members and close friends, as well as press colleagues who've supported her throughout her career. She's also spoken out about the growing challenges that Palestinian journalists are facing, from media blackouts to the targeting of the press themselves. In this episode, we take a closer look at a powerful voice of activism from Gaza, a Palestinian who has transformed the haunting trauma and the loss that she's experienced at the age of 14 during the Israeli war on Gaza in 2014 into tireless advocacy and activism. Welcome, Yara. Yara, it is such a pleasure to finally have you on the This is Palestine podcast. Welcome, welcome.
Thank you so much, Nayani. I really was looking forward to this from a long time, and it's amazing to speak to you personally. All of us, we're big fans of your work.
It's actually the opposite. I've been a fan of yours for quite some time, and I've been in awe
watching you as you've navigated everything that you've lived through, and you've lived through a lot. So Yad, I want to step back for a second, and I want to just ask you to take us to the beginning. You are a journalist. You've worked in human rights. Why? What prompted you? Why were these the chosen fields when you could have done anything?
It all started in 2014 because I grew up in Gaza, as you know, and 2008 was the first assault on Gaza, and then 2012 it happened again, and they used white phosphorus, and they really traumatized us. But I was too little to know the meaning of death or fear. I was just a kid. I was a little kid, just like all of these kids that are being terrorized now. And I was 14 in 2014, and I remember escaping my refugee camp where I grew up my whole life, in Al Burej camp, and going to Rafah city, which, as you know now, is being obliterated and it doesn't exist anymore. But it's my grandparents' house. So I used to go there every Eid. We used to have sleepovers with my cousin. Rafah was like my traveling out of Gaza. It felt very far, even though Gaza is very small, but it felt like we were going on a trip. And we went to Rafah, we arrived. I remember we spent 10 days. Diana, I felt like I was in Canada. There was electricity, there was water, there was internet. I could talk to my cousins. I could follow up the news. And it was relatively quiet compared to Le Brej. And then on the last night of the what it was called the war, they announced a ceasefire. And as you know, we should never trust Israel with ceasefires. As we come closer to six, they start intensifying the bombs. And it felt like they're bombing my house that I was in, my teta's house. And the bombs get more intensified and more intensified, and I didn't know what it was happening. And the bombs are getting closer and closer and more terrifying. And then my parents wake up and my brother starts crying. He was only 11. And we start realizing, you know, maybe this is an invasion. Maybe we need to leave, because suddenly they start bombing our neighbor's house and the smoke fills in my house. My teta just had an operation and she's barely able to walk. We're running on the streets, me with my brother, him refusing to leave his marbles, me with whatever I could carry with my weak body as a 14-year-old. My dad, we're all standing in a line. We're not trying to be in a big gathering. And my dad is trying to be strong for us, even though I could see he's very scared. He's scared for us more than himself. We start running in the streets and then we call an ambulance. And the ambulance comes to get us. There is 500 feet between us. And then they bomb in front of the ambulance and behind him to prevent him from getting to us. So we keep running. And at that point, my grandma can't walk. So we try to carry her as much as I could. We left the stuff on the street, our belongings. We're running. I'm scared for the first time, but I don't show any point of my emotion. Nothing. I scream at my mother in a more encouraging way. Come on, you're my mom. You have to be strong for us. Don't cry. We're fine. We're safe. We're going to be safe. Mama, yalla. My brother is crying. My teta is crying. Everyone is crying. But Yara is refusing to accept the reality she's in. And at that point, I could remember just thinking, if I survive this, if I manage to get out of this alive, the only thing I'm going to do is I'm going to write a book about this. So we keep running, and I remember at that point there was an orange taxi, you know, like the old taxis in Palestine, and it was open, the doors were open, and I was very confused. I was like, that's not safe, but what is safety at that point? And I see literally limbs hanging out of the car, and I was 14, Diana, I was 14, I didn't know that I could see this at 14. And I'm not the only kid. I bet that kids at 11, at 10, at 9, at 5 have seen more than I've seen at that point. And I get shocked. And at that point, I'm just like, I don't think we're going to make it. Like, everyone is being killed. Like, at that point, I'm speechless. And then we run, we walk really, like, far. So from Hayl Jnane, which is a neighborhood in Rafah, to Ashabura. And on foot, it's a long way with a grandma that can barely walk and children with their marbles and toys. And we walk, and then our family has to split into two because my mom was like, well, if we die, if I have to, like, half of us have to survive. So my mom took my brother and my dad took me. And then at some point, I just arrived to like a turning point, like, so you can go either into inside the camp, Shabura or not. And that's where my cousins and my aunt was living. And then I see my cousin and I think I saw safety when I saw him because one familiar face finally, and I just collapse on the ground and I faint. And I don't remember what happened after. Later, a few days later, we are in Khan Yunis, displaced at my uncle's wife's house. In Palestine, everyone is related somehow. Everyone is everyone's friend. Everyone is everyone's family. And we learn this by apartheid, by occupation. We are born to protect each other. We are born to love each other. After that day, I realized I can't be just normal, Yara. I can't just grow up and be a doctor, treat patients that will have limbs broken or cut from Israeli weapons, but I need to tell the world about what I saw. And it was a promise I made to myself about the book I was writing. And I almost fulfilled that dream. I'm writing now, maybe not the book yet, but I'm writing, I'm telling the world about what I saw and what we're still seeing. And after that, just life was not the same. I aged 10 years by seeing what I saw. I got sick. I entered the hospital, Diana. I was traumatized. I had PTSD severe, but the only difference that it was not post, it was still going because the bombs would not stop. And no one knew what's wrong with me because we don't have a great mental health, like you know, facilities in Gaza. And I kept puking and I couldn't eat. My body was literally in survival mode. And after 2 months, and my mom was smart, she got me into a psychiatrist, her friend, and I realized what was happening to me and I started understanding. And that, when I got better, even though I dropped out of school, imagine, I was the top of my class. And this is how it happens to many Palestinian children. Mental health is, you know, 99% of Gazawi children have PTSD, but it's not post, as I said, it's still going. And I got back to school after I got a bit better, started eating again. I lost half of my weight. You know, I was dehydrated. I almost died, literally, not from the bombs, but from the aftermath. And this is something we forget to talk about, the aftermath of violence. It's a psychological warfare. And sometimes the scars of psychological warfare can be much deeper than physical ones. After that, I decided, you know what? I'm not staying in Palestine. I need to go out and tell the world about what I witnessed so no child can hear the sounds of bombs more than the sounds of birds. And I traveled. I managed to get a scholarship at the age of 16. And I got on the first plane, you know. I had to go to Egypt first. And they denied my father entry because they do. And then I went from Egypt to London. Yara, from a tiny refugee camp in Gaza, a war-torn country, into London, one of the biggest and busiest and most international, you know, cities in the world. I didn't speak any English. I could say, hello, my name is Yara, I'm from Palestine. I couldn't even differentiate between my P's and B's. And when I was in Gaza, I interned at Ain Media, which is a media production company in Gaza. And Rushdie Sarraj was my boss. May he rest in peace. Yeah, Rushdie took me as a little girl and really taught me everything. He was a great, great person. Everyone loved him. He was a great mentor. And I came from London and I was like, listen, Rushdie, like, I am ready to embark on this journey with you. And he was the greatest teacher of all times. And I have to talk about his legacy for the rest of my life, you know. And his wife, you know, who continued his legacy now and restarted in media and is raising an child who is going to be as brave as her father. And I remember when the 2021 assault happened in Gaza, I was in the office. And then my best friend, Ibrahim, who is my camera person, I remember they got an airstrike announcement or like a thing. And then Rushdie jumped into the press car and like with Sari, my other colleague, and Ibrahim. And Ibrahim, before he jumped in, he just threw like a press vest at me and I wore it. And I covered the aggression from the ground. It was not, it's not like anything I've done before, Diana. It's heavy.
But, you know, normally when people are covering, I don't like to use the term, but let's use it, wars, they're covering somebody else's. And here you were, you were covering your own. You were covering your own. Can you talk a little bit about that, Yara? Because that's what the journalists today are facing. And not only are they facing that today, as they did during when you were there in 2021 and other journalists did in 2014 and in 2018 and in all of the years, but it's also that they are not believed by many of the Western press. Can you talk a little bit about that?
I think it's one of the most, and I swear I don't say it because I am a journalist, it's one of the most conflicting jobs in the world. You are there as a human before anything else. I believe that everyone is subjective in some way or another because I'm reporting on my cousins or on my home that I grew up in. How can I be objective when I see my memories being wiped off? I believe that there's nothing called, you know, objective journalism. You can try your best, but we have to recognize our positionality when it comes to these things. And when I covered it, it happened in a very weird way because I was still traumatized and I was in therapy for years to get over what I saw in 2014, what I mentioned to you. And I didn't even mention the full details, you know, of like my best friend's house being bombed and not knowing if she was alive or not, and then her losing her father, who was like a father to me, etc. And like all of these things. But I think when I was on the ground, I didn't feel fear, which is weird. We are the ones who report the news. We are the ones who hold the mothers while they are weeping their loss, their losses. We are the ones who transfer patients sometimes. Sometimes I have to turn off my camera and actually help in real life. And you have to be ready for all of this. It's a lot. It's a lot. You have to be very quick instincts, very quick reflexes. And it's honestly what I can say. It's a lot. And you keep asking yourself, how can I be a better journalist? How can I report the news in a very humane way? How can I not dehumanize my people? How would I like to be reported on if I was the victim? I always ask myself this. If I see a woman who got shot and she's not in a very modest or like very private setting, would I be wanted to be, would I want someone to take pictures of me? I always ask myself this. Or if I get a news headline and I want to break it online or for a channel, I would always ask, am I 100% sure? If I'm 99% sure, I wouldn't report it, Diana. And that is what distinguishes a good journalist from just a mediocre one. Because if you are doubting everything you see, if you are not helping the fake news spread, which the occupation wants that, wants the population to be even more scared. So I think it's one thing not to be just go viral. It's the ethics behind it. It's understanding the privacy of others, understanding the importance of a picture and when to take a picture. And Rushdie was the greatest teacher of all times about this. You know, sometimes we would arrive to a location, we drive like half an hour, and in the war, to drive half an hour, it's a long way, you know. Wallahi, Diana, we'd arrive and there would be like so many phones, people trying to take pictures, not journalists. Rushdie would be like, get back in the car. I'm like, no, I'm mad, you know. I'm like, no, what do you mean we drove? There is something, I need to report on it. He's like, Yara, one day you'll learn when to be a journalist and when to just let go. And me and my colleagues try as much as we could to honor the ethics of journalism. So yeah, it's a really tough job, but I don't think I can do anything else, Diana. It's my passion.
So one of the things that I was telling you this before we started, one of the things that first caught my attention about you was the interview that you did with Sky News, which went viral. And as I was telling you, I wish that I had the strength at your age that you have to
sure
really
did,
take it
honestly.
On. Oh,
in
no.
Some other way.
Not at all.
Come on, you lived in Haifa. I'm sure you saw some soldiers and, you know, didn't care and still was very brave. I mean, I believe every Palestinian is very brave in their own way to still exist under an apartheid and a genocide. I mean, look at us now.
That means we're survivors.
Yeah, exactly.
So talk us through this interview. What was happening? And what's happened since?
I got in the interview and then there's a problem with the way she frames the whole, like, what's happening. She says 1,400 Israelis have been killed and 25,000 Palestinians have died. Or something, a number, I don't care, 5,000, whatever. And I swear, like, she introduces me and I don't care whatever she says. I just go and I'm like, I can't believe you just said Israelis get killed. Like, this was so easy. She gave it to me on a plate, you know? So easy. I didn't even have to do any work. She was like, I was like, you can't say Israelis get killed and Palestinians die. We don't just drop dead. Like, what? We don't have some natural disaster that suddenly makes us die. Like, I'm sure, as a journalist, you have a moral responsibility to say things as they are. You are twisting the truth. You are literally referring to us as subhuman. We just die? Like, what is that language? And I told her, I'm sure that I have a grasp of the English language and that is just racist. Like, that is just like, you literally twisted the whole idea of what's happening. And She stayed silent. That was the best comeback. She just couldn't say one word. And then she says, but then she talks about how many people I've lost. I've lost a lot of my family members. Allah yarhamhum, may they rest in peace. Like 90 members or something. And she says, I swear it's a joke. The whole interview is just a joke. She says, you know, but what did you expect to happen after the Hamas attack? I told her, sure, I did not expect 90 members of my family to be killed when they are not members of Hamas. What do you mean, what did you expect? And then the question, the favorite question. I feel like when they were in journalism schools, the first question they got taught is, do you condemn Hamas? Wallahi al-Azim, before Hamas existed, they knew this question. Do you condemn Hamas? I'm like, sorry, darling, I'm not condemning something I'm not part of. Why? I'm not a spokesperson for Hamas. Why am I condemning a whole party when I have nothing to do with them? Like, I wish I asked her, like, do you condemn? I think I did. Do you condemn the killing of Palestinians? Do you condemn the ethnic cleansing of us? Do you condemn the burning of our villages? Do you condemn the torture of our minors in prison cells, in literally prison chambers, you know? And yeah, honestly, I just left her speechless. And I love my online community. It went super viral. It was the biggest, like, interview that went viral. I think it has 20 million views on my Instagram now. Mm-hmm. And then the comments were just like so funny. It's just like they made me feel good. And I think I spoke and I did something that everyone felt that they need to say, but they always get, like, gaslit into thinking they have to condemn Hamas, otherwise they're a terrorist, or that language doesn't matter. But she really didn't have any ethics as a journalist. And I'm not afraid to say so. I haven't met many Western journalists who have ethics, to be honest, which is a big statement, and I'm generalizing, but it is true. And listen, I'm 24, and I still can't forget one day I lived through in Palestine. Every airplane is a trigger. Every loud noise is a trigger. Every slam of a door is a trigger. And it brings me back. I still have nightmares about what I witnessed. And I'm sure many of us, even you, have it.
I was going to ask, what do you think needs to change? But we should also talk about that aspect of it as well. So first, let's talk about what needs to change in the media, and then let's talk about the issues that people don't talk about, which is mental health.
Yeah. I think number one is we need more educators who are coming from war zones, who are coming from Palestine, who are coming from Yemen, who are coming from Lebanon. People like you, Diana, you know, you're doing a great job in that and like shifting narratives. And we need more media outlets to be including of Palestinian voices, to be amplifying Palestinian voices, and not just only, you know, trying to put them on the spotlight to trick them. Yeah.
So Yara, you have now quite a following for obvious reasons, right?
Try to be funny and political.
For obvious reasons, you have a massive following and a huge, very powerful platform of close to a million followers. And what responsibility do you feel having that voice? And then what advice would you give to Palestinians or really anyone who wants to speak out in terms of what's happening?
It genuinely feels great to have a platform because this is what makes us feel heard. This is what makes me feel like less alone, especially when I'm living in London, not in Palestine, and dreaming every single day. Wallahi, I dream every single day to go to Gaza. Wallahi, if they open the border now, after tomorrow, I'm going straight away. It's a huge responsibility because I have like this voice, and it's giving me more responsibility because I have to represent my people. I have to represent those unheard stories, unheard voices, children who are screaming and crying in the darkness. So I try my best to listen to my audience as much as I speak as well, because sometimes they are asking for questions that I sometimes don't have the answers to, and I can direct them to other people, or sometimes we can grow together and plan big protests. Like I spoke a few weeks ago at a London protest, there was like 500,000 people. A year and a half into the genocide, 500,000 people decide, they come from all over the UK, take the train, come and protest for Palestine. And we are seeing a growing movement, definitely. More articles have been written, more protests like ever. Like, I think it's the biggest protesting in history, maybe after Black Lives Matter or even before, I don't know. I don't know the statistic, but yeah, we're seeing more and more like advocacy, more and more Palestinian spaces, and we're having more and more awareness at schools. We're seeing school kids. This is my favorite. I have a lot of followers who send me their school kids, like writing me letters or wearing a Palestine flag or speaking about Palestine. And I think our generation and the new generation is the generation to free Palestine and to end all colonialism legacies, you know? So it's a great, great responsibility. And some people don't, they either monetize of it or don't take it as seriously. And I don't like that. I think it's a huge, huge responsibility.
One of the things that you have been very open about are the issues in relation to mental health. And you talked a little bit about it when it comes to, as you put it, there's no P when it comes to the PTSD, because there's no post when it comes to for the kids.
Yeah. Like,
can you talk a little bit about that?
I remember I was in my house in London, and I remember I went out of the house, and I haven't been out for 2 months. 2 months, literally, just confined into my room, and I felt what the prisoners feel like, but at least I could go to the kitchen. I mean, I don't know. I was so scared of leaving the house. I got death threats. I got, they're going to kill my mom. They're going to do. So I was scared. I left the house the first day alone. I'm walking in the street and there's a helicopter, like a helicopter in the sky in London. Wallahi al-azim, I thought they are bombing me. I ran back into the house and I told my flatmates, guys, we have to evacuate, they're bombing me. Imagine, and I'm actually in my like brain, like I'm in my mental capacity. And I thought they are gonna bomb me, the Israelis. So imagine to go through that level of trauma. Imagine what it feels like for the kids. Wallahi, my generation, we don't know what it felt like. You know, in your generation, you can say the old good days. But what are the old good days, Yani, for us? We don't have old good days. يعني أنا I was born in 2000, it was the second intifada, بعدين 2008 أول حرب, بعدين 2000, sorry, the first war, then 2014 and 2012 and 14 and 21 and then 22 and then 23 and now we're going into 24 or 5. يعني شو؟ يعني what? For how long more? But you know, I didn't want to have kids, and I really, really thought of the idea of giving birth to children who could have my traumatic genes. And like, you will, like, even if I give birth in London and they grew up their whole life in London, they are still subjected to trauma because I just witnessed trauma. And it's crazy. In medicine, genes are trauma genes, like they pass through generations. So I obviously have the genes of trauma from my mother, from her grandmother who fled Limghar in 1948, etc. And you know, I didn't want them. But then my friend told me something. He's like, you're letting them win. They want to shrink us. And now I'm going to have so many babies. So get ready, guys. You know, I'm going to have as many babies and I'm going to call them, you know, Watan for homeland. I'm going to call them Ibrahim for my best friend who was killed. And I always say, Israel wants you to believe that you can't do anything, but this is literally their colonialism talking and scaring you. You, one person can do so much. Imagine you help one Palestinian family. You help, I don't know, fundraise, educate one Palestinian student like they did with me. And look, I would have never been here. I would have not spoken English. But, you know, it's a lot can be done. We have, I mean, God created us with so much creativity and so much thinking. Yani, what differentiates us from animals? Yani, sorry, but what? You know, it's our brains and our heart and how we go on. If we manage to dismantle the greatest oppression of all times, which is slavery, I mean, still exists somehow, but not like before. And if we manage to dismantle apartheid South Africa, why not Palestine? Yani, I give it a few years, wallah, we will be in a free Palestine and I will be dancing dabke and eating knafa.
You know, I'm gonna end it here because I'm gonna tell you what I always tell my friends. Is that one day we're going to be free and we're going to have the biggest, baddest party.
Oh.
And you're all invited.
Oh, please invite me though. I recommend, I think if there's one thing for the audience, which you might have want to ask me about, but I recommend you to listen to more Palestinian voices. So listen to This is Palestine by Diana. It's amazing. I always listen to it on the train or in my free time. I like it. And then read Palestinian authors, read Suzanne Abulhawa, read Mahmoud Darwish, read the new authors. Imkin, maybe you read my book one day, you know. Amplify our voices and don't give up. It's so lame to give up, you know. Be cool like me and don't give up.
We're going to be salty like you and cool like you at the same time.
Yeah.
Yara, it's really been a pleasure. It really has.
Thank you for listening to This is Palestine, a podcast brought to you by the Institute for Middle East Understanding. The IMEU is a nonprofit focused on giving you access to untold stories, facts, and expert sources on all things Palestine. For more information, please visit our website at www.imeu.org and follow us on Facebook. If you missed parts of the show, you can go to Security's website at security.ca and listen to it again. All the episodes are archived on our page. Just click on the name of the show and you will find them. You will also find the link to the archive on CFRC's website at cfrc.ca. You are listening to Under the Olive Tree, the Palestine Solidarity Radio Show on CQUT 90.3 FM in Montreal and on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Until next time, I wish you a free, free Palestine.